Welcome to the OnFit podcast.
Hello and welcome to the OnFit DMI podcast, where we discuss key trends and new developments in innovation and the policy, technology and regulatory challenges in all things related to digital finance. I'm Kate Chan Wilson, Head of Policy Analysis from OnFit, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Pietro Grassano, Business Solutions Director for Europe at Algorand, who also sits on our DMI steering committee. Welcome, Pietro.
Hello, thank you.
Thank you. So today we're going to talk about what is tokenized money and do we need it both domestically and cross-border. This is ahead of our Future of Cross-Border Payments report in partnership with Algorand, which will be released on December 14th. This is the DMI's annual benchmark report, bringing together industry stakeholders to explore the role of CBDC, traditional versus new technological infrastructure for cross-border payments, as well as next steps for global coordination. Now, Pietro, currently different people seem to define tokens or tokenization in so many different ways. It's intended sometimes to mean ownership or architecture or single tier or DLT or identification. So big question for you first. How can we even begin to define tokenization when it comes to payments? Is it synonymous with blockchain or with public and private money or decentralization?
Well, I suspect that a new word should mean something new, right? Yeah. Otherwise, we would be happy with the old words. And that something new needs to be thought pretty thoroughly, though. So, I mean, tokenization, in my mind at least, hopefully I've been thinking about it, essentially is the representation of value in the digital age on a platform that allows avoiding double spending by design. So essentially on a blockchain, right?
Yep.
That's how you can make use of a token in order to represent value so that it cannot be copied and pasted. So that it cannot be falsified, tampered, and so that it keeps its own characteristics of authenticity, of unicity, of scarcity. And this is something new at the extent we understand that the blockchain is an infrastructure that allows exactly this, the representation of value with no double spending by design in an age, the digital age, where everything can be represented as a string of zeros and ones, and hence, in principle, could be copied and pasted. So this, to me, is essentially the novelty of the tokenization world. Then, of course, we can use the word tokenization for many different types of values. It can be related to payment tools. It can be related to the representation of the value of a work of art or the representation of security, right?
Yeah.
So both novel business models can arise from this new way of doing things. And old ways of doing things, old ways of conceiving value can be thought. That's why, to me, it's pretty exciting. And this is an innovation in the true sense.
No, certainly. Would you also categorize it as a type of dematerialization, or do you think this doesn't do it justice?
Well, other types of dematerialization are always possible, but if you need to keep on asking the butcher if his meat is good, so if you keep having a centralizer that is guaranteeing you that, yes, the dematerialization went well and did a good job and therefore there cannot be double spending, well, I think that you lose the infrastructure angle that the blockchain allows you to put in place. The idea is that through the works or the work of the validators, you avoid to the need of many different notaries, many different intermediaries, guaranteeing the fact that this digital representation hasn't been double spent. And of course, that's all fine. That's the way the digital world has been working the last 40 years, unless there is something new that works better. And to me, this is the blockchain.
Mm-hmm. So then would you, I suppose, be more leaning towards, yeah, the token as synonymous with blockchain and, in essence, some removal of intermediaries?
Well, it depends in which context we are talking about tokenized forms of, for instance, money. For instance, there is this sort of dichotomy between tokenized models, token-based models and account-based models when we are talking about central bank digital currencies that I suspect are not necessarily well representing the reality. In the sense that also on a blockchain, you can have certain characteristics that we tend in the literature to attributes that we tend to link to traditional systems and account-based logics. For instance, the ability of performing AML, KYC, counter-terrorist financing. And we are used to do this via accounts, right? Checking accounts and so on. At the same time, in the public narrative, the logic is the one of opposing to this account-based form, the token-based forms, in which you would lose somehow certain elements of traceability that the accounts allow you to perform. I don't think it's a correct representation in the sense that also on blockchains, you can have an account-based type of model, and there can be hybrid models that are both token-based and account-based. So this distinction doesn't help a lot in the sense that, for instance, on a blockchain, you have a public key linked with a private key. Transactions are and identities are pseudonymous. They are not anonymous. Mm. Therefore, behind the couple public and private key, there is essentially an account, and there can be KYC AML type of logics, right? Can be imposed to even to blockchain. At the same time, I think that having an idea that is the one of being token-based is a bit more attuned to the models of transactions, for instance, via private wallets, via the utilization of smartphones and so on and so forth, that are more in line with the needs of the digital age. So while I link the token-based definition to the blockchain, and therefore I see it as something innovative if related to the blockchain, I don't see it in an exclusive manner. It doesn't cut out certain prerogatives and characteristics that are typical in our mindset of account-based systems.
Yeah, no, that's very clear. And so you mentioned this double spending as a unique feature of blockchain and tokens.
Yeah, the avoidance of.
Yeah, the avoidance of, sorry. And the AML CFT that we've known to link with accounts be possible with tokens. But are there any other features that are unique to this sort of tokenization and blockchain technology that you can't currently get with account-based systems?
Well, I think the overarching innovation is related to the fact that you have an architecture that prevents the single point of failure problem, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, by definition, the reason for you may prefer a distributed technology, a distributed decision-making process to a concentrated one, because any concentrated decision-making process has the single point of failure problem. Centralization presents this specific system theory type of problem, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's less resilient by definition. So I mean, top down, I would say that the characteristics of DLTs and blockchain specifically are those of avoiding this problem, again, by design, therefore avoiding as well the copy-paste problem by design with no single point of failure, which makes the whole architecture more robust, less costly, potentially quicker with the right consensus mechanism, and so on and so forth. All the other characteristics that we tend to talk about when we talk about tokens, so the programmability and so on and so forth, are not necessarily unique to DLT, but can coexist with DLT. And therefore, the combination of the network effect of a distributed ledger technology with the possibilities that are allowed by programmability, for instance, of money, give us an endless spectrum of positive fallouts. The ability to conceive ways to trigger payments in a certain way down the line. The ability to, for instance, split, solve the VAT problem, splitting the payment at the source between the merchant and the VAT account in an automatic manner. Having also, other characteristics related to the ability of avoiding counterparty risk via truly atomic transactions. All things that centralized system, actually cannot do.
No, that's very clear. I think the programmability point is very confusing in the literature, so it's very useful for listeners to hear that you can get it in both account and token systems, but actually it's the centralization versus decentralization point, which is the unique features, I think is what you're saying.
Yeah, essentially, yes. I think that the centralization allows to represent value in the digital age without necessarily keeping on asking to the butcher if his meat is good. So having a centralizer that keeps on guaranteeing for each and every step. And that's frictionality. It adds frictionality at every level. It adds frictionality in terms of cost, in terms of time, in terms of risk, which in infrastructure with no single point of failure and with no double spending by design, takes care of since the onset.
And then just briefly before we move on to cross-border, I'd be interested to know, how does this link to trust more widely? You've mentioned before, you've linked this to trust before, and I think a great quote that you've said is, it's minimally invasive trust creation. Can you just explain a bit more how this links to trust?
Absolutely. I mean, as long as you don't need to ask the butcher if his meat is good,
yeah.
Right? Then this creates an environment where, again, the infrastructure takes care of checking that there is no double spending. Yeah. And therefore, I can allocate my trust to other situations that require that trust much more than a simple transaction. When I go to the supermarket and I pay in cash and I buy an apple in exchange of my cash, I have a transaction which is essentially atomic, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a pretty little consumption of the trust capital that arises from said transaction. While when I am doing a set of wire transfers in order to send money to the other side of the world, maybe in exchange for a financial product, there is a complexity in terms of trust between the various intermediaries and potentially risks related to the counterparties that actually become much more invasive, that requires, for instance, regulatory capital to be set aside in front of the counterparty risk because of the counterparty risk. Imagine a situation in which the infrastructure takes care of this, and that regulatory capital can be freed are for better uses than to be left into a reserve to allow other transactions, right? Mm-hmm. So again, it's nice to have a lot of trust, probably the ability to allocate it in an efficient manner comes as well with the ability to work on the most innovative infrastructures available. Like, for instance, allocating someone's money in pairs of shoes instead of allocating it for a train ticket allows you to save money when having to do a 200 kilometers journey. You go by train instead of going by foot.
Yeah, and I really like your phrase, trust capital. I think that's a good coining. And you've already mentioned how it currently requires extra regulatory capital to be set aside. So there's similar overlaps, I imagine, with cross-border payments. But I want to just ask you now if there are any specific features of payment tokens that can help cross-border payments, the current frictions, and also whether this has to be central bank issued or not. You mentioned CBDCs already. Can some of these features that you discuss also be achieved with a private sector solution? So basically, are the benefits of tokenized commercial bank money for cross-border payments as well?
Yeah. Okay. So I would say that generally speaking, the way I see payment tools or payment systems and so on are related to a partnership between the private sector and the public sector, right? Mm-hmm. It is already today like that, in the sense that you have central bank money, but you have as well commercial bank money, not necessarily represent the liability of the central bank. For instance, in the European Union, we have the e-money regulation that allows the creation of commercial bank money as long as you are able to demonstrate the ability to perform the appropriate KYC AML procedures and you have a specific, you are meeting specific capital requirements, right? Then you can issue commercial bank money. When I go and buy with my ATM card an orange juice, well, this is not a liability of the central bank. It's a liability of my own commercial bank. And then there is the reserve logic between the commercial bank and the central bank and potentially some safety nets up to a certain amount of the deposit. So there is a coexistence already today of central bank money and commercial bank money.
Yeah.
There is the logic of the fractional reserve that we need to keep in mind. In this sense, I see the same type of model potentially being put in place when it comes to central bank digital currency or payment systems based on blockchain logics in tokenized form, if we want to mention it like that. I can see very well a wholesale CBDC granting some intermediation between the banking system and the central bank. And I can see then the ability of commercial bank to issue what is a mean of payment that is commercial bank money based on certain reserves that they may have with the central bank. And this would represent essentially a form of locally regulated, locally governed stable coin, right? Which with the appropriate regulation, well, it exists already today. And is particularly efficient in allowing people to make payment, instant payment, and so on and so forth. So I suspect that the private sector will move in this direction, perhaps even quicker and earlier than central banks for their own part. So it's easy for me to see a sort of parallel with the existing digital money construct without necessarily having a central bank digital currency that is outright a retail liability of the central bank. It's not the job of the central bank to keep the records of all the clients and so on and so forth. Yeah. And probably, collectively, we are better off in a situation in which there is some competition between the private sector players, so that there is no single owner of all the data, right? Also in terms of privacy, this type of model seems to me probably better suited for the protection of privacy of the client.
Do you think then, so you said you can imagine a shift where you've got tokenized commercial bank money, locally governed stable coins that you've already mentioned, some already exist today, we're going to see more of them. But at some point, do we need a wholesale CBDC? And what do you think will be the trigger? Is there any motivation on the sort of money side, or do we need to see tokenization of capital markets first?
Well, I think that the two things will go in parallel. Okay. I think that capital markets have a lot to gain from a better infrastructure. Not just when it comes to the cross-border logics. Just think to a transaction that entails essentially virtually no operational counterpart risk, because you don't have to wait T plus two, T plus three. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, for the transaction, the trade to be settled, the settlement is essentially happens together with the trade. And in this way, you can free up regulatory capital. This is a win for capital markets, immediate, right?
Mm-hmm.
An immediate type of win. So, I think the two things will go in parallel, and therefore also for the wholesale central bank digital currency, for interbank settlement, there is this sort of benefit potentially.
Yeah. No, certainly. So that's a good answer. In parallel, there won't be one triggering the other, which I think many people want an answer to. If you look at though the FSB, their building blocks for cross-border payments, I think only one or two mentions blockchain. So what do you think? Why are policymakers still scratching their heads about this? Do you think there's a misunderstanding or what needs to be clarified with them? I know scalability is obviously mentioned when it comes to cross-border payments, but mm-hmm. security and what you've discussed here seems to be quite solved. So what's missing here?
Oh, yeah, but probably it's because my perspective is a pretty specific one.
Mm-hmm.
I represent Algorand's blockchain that solves problems of scalability, mm-hmm. of security, and of decentralization of the legacy protocols. So I know that actually the thing can work, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the, I know because I have the tangible proof, right?
Yeah.
And some central banks with whom we are working, pilots and tests and so on, are starting to realize this as well. And experimenting in a tangible manner, for instance, the logics of how to manage KYC AML in a decentralized world will allow to take out of the equation some, I would say, gross misunderstandings that still are around in our own market. For instance, that blockchain is anonymous. No, blockchain is not. Blockchain is pseudonymous, which is better from being anonymous. Blockchain allows elements of traceability, which doesn't necessarily bring blockchain to be an instrument of the big brother, but of course requires a specific governance of up to which point we want to trace things. So, interesting enough, right, you have from the regulators objections that are related to the lack of control or to the excess of control, while the right level of control is a purely political decision, right? And it's not necessarily related to the infrastructure. A road can be a road bringing around thieves and police or an army for good and bad reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my idea here is that there are some myths that needs to be dispelled. for instance, the fact that blockchain consumes a lot of energy. Hey, no, it's no more the case. Via the evolution that blockchain, like every technology, is having, we've invented protocols that are, again, minimally invasive, very efficient, that are probably more efficient than centralized systems, given the ability to process a very important amount of information through a decentralized ledger. Mm-hmm. The inability of imposing AML KYC, the fact that it's an instrument prone to speculation, hey, yes, there are meme coins and people that are manipulating market related to meme coins. But this is not necessarily a consequence of the technology, right? And the technology allows you to do many other things, and you should better think what are the things that the technology allows you to do. So that's, in my opinion, the sort of path that we need collectively to undergo. For instance, ability to perform traceability and avoid money laundering. Listen, just think of to this logical hypothesis. You want to launder some money, right? Are you sure you want to do it on a tamper-proof ledger, a registry that remains with your traces forever? Mm-hmm. Are you sure? I mean, it looks to me that the old style banknotes in a suitcase is probably still the right way to go.
Yeah. No, right? And then, but then in terms of the centralization versus decentralization, I have actually heard a big benefit of blockchain being referred to as actually centralization, but in the way that you can get everyone onto the same system internationally. I mean, that could be quite revolutionary, but how do you do that? Because before that happens, you've got all these different blockchains with all different standards. So how do you get to the point where...
I see your point. So let me rephrase the question, if I may. No, in a purely theoretical logic, having one single ledger at the global level, with the most extreme decentralization possible, would be somehow the solution. But this doesn't exist today. As of today, we have multiple protocols with multiple logics, and some elements of interoperability that are just at the first stages. I think you are pretty right. Yes, there is still a lot to do before going to a situation where there can be one single standard, like it happened, for instance, for TCP/IP in the internet, right? Which to me remains a pretty good metaphor of what the blockchain tries to do. The internet is an infrastructure for data, and the blockchain is an infrastructure for value. How do we get to a situation in which there is a single global worldwide standard? Thinking about the early internet days, I think that an important part of the job has been done by the standardization bodies, ITU, ISO, UNCFAC, CENELEC, and so on, right? And what is happening today is that these bodies are looking at the blockchain as well and are trying to find common denominators, I would say, elements of standard, which I think is a positive angle. And the same, also because, I mean, we are talking about an infrastructure that, as we said, both public sector considerations and private sector consideration. I think, though, that due to the specificity of this infrastructure, so to the fact that it's an infrastructure for the representation and exchange of value, probably a little less top-down approach will be allowed by the market participants in the sense that there will be more competition, right?
Yeah.
Because, of course, there will be probably more vested interests to be managed than those that could be managed via the standardization bodies at the early internet days. That's my feeling, right? So, yeah, there will be a set of competitive choices to be made. For sure, there is not a lack of offering out in the market. But I think that among these offerings, those that will win will be those that actually solve truly the problems of scalability, decentralization, and cryptographical security. We know that there is a quantum computing threat that is probably going to happen, going to be a real problem earlier than later. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the winners will also be those that are going to be good in creating the bridges, the interoperability bridges among the various protocols. And when I mean good, it doesn't mean that they are going to be good in creating interfaces. Those bridges will have to be consistent with the decentralized nature of the decision-making process that happens on each and every blockchain, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those able to conceive decentralized token bridges, so to be able to bring on their own chain, if it is quicker, cheaper, faster, more robust and secure, well, they will be the winners.
And you think so, like, not top down, but more competition will likely solve this, you think?
Yeah. That's the way, I mean, if you think about banking, central banking, the history of money, and therefore the history of representational value, that's how the thing has been moving ahead, right?
Yeah.
Less related to moments of standardization. Yes, there have been moments of standardization, but there have been moments of participation of the economic agents that have been able to create new invention, to bring new technologies to the table, invent double entry bookkeeping. Imagine double entry bookkeeping is a technology in itself, right?
Yeah.
And wasn't existing before the 14th century.
Yeah. I think also the evolution of technology is a lot messier than people realize. They always, we're asking policymakers for all these rules and guidance, which is obviously useful.
Agree.
But it's just, it's going to unfold in a messy way.
Absolutely. No. I mean, I don't want to be misunderstood here. I'm not saying that the private sector alone is going to be able to solve, for instance, some market failures that are typical of the innovation process, right? Mm-hmm. We keep on doing the example of inferior technologies winning the competitive competition because of the ability to corner the market and so on and so forth. No, the VHS versus Betamax story when it comes to videotapes in the early 80s, probably end of the 70s, is a good example. In this specific infrastructure that is probably a bit more relevant and important and with ramifications and fallouts than the videotape one, the public sector will have to and is having an attention to what is happening. So again, it will be a combination of efforts from the private sector and the public sector. Like in every infrastructure, right? Every functioning infrastructure has joint effort from the private sector entrepreneurs with their ability to conceive new things and new protocols and new solutions to problems that are often old as the mankind. And at the same time, the ability to combine the individual efforts in a public effort.
And the central banks or the policymakers, I guess, should be more of a referee and try to enable, yeah, fair competition than be involved.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I mean, on that note, we're out of time today, but thank you so much, Pietro. It's been an absolute pleasure, as always, to explore tokenization with you. And we hope we've provided some clarity to this fast-moving discussion to our listeners. Don't forget to subscribe. We release podcasts every Tuesday and Thursday on topics from digital finance, monetary policy, and green finance. As mentioned, we are covering these themes in our DMI benchmark report, which you can download using the link in the bio here or visit onfif.com/DMI. Thanks so much, Pietro, and have a great rest of your day.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.